This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mare Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we're covering A Game of Thrones, three chapters covering the perspectives of Tyrion, Arya, and Daenerys. In these chapters, Tyrion has a little heart-to-heart with Jor Mormont. I don't know how to say Jorah's dad's name, Jor Mormont.
I think it's Jor. Jor Mormont.
Yeah. And then poor Arya's clearly so traumatized still by Micah's death.
I know, that chapter made me really sad.
Yep. And Dany is starting to get her bearings and her understand her place in the Dothraki horde. I know. So are you? Yeah, sure. I'm sure you're relieved to not have to deal with the Catelyn chapter.
I am. And you know what? Daenerys is also a really good point of view because it's a complete different world as well, isn't it? Than, you know, Westeros and kings and queens.
Because we don't get any other Essos chapters of different perspective until Dance of Dragons when Tyrion gets there, and then with like certain members of the Martell family out there, you know, and, you know, things like that.
Exactly. So I really, really enjoy Dany's chapters. They are really interesting to see other cultures and other places, and I really enjoy seeing her coming to like her own.
Mm-hmm. Yes, with Targaryens. Yesterday was the release of the new House of the Dragon trailer.
Yes, the teaser trailer. I don't know if it was highly anticipated. Yeah, highly anticipated trailer. I don't know if it was after that horrible last season. I don't know if people are excited about it, but
yeah, that's the thing. It's like, is it better to try and do damage control in like a sort of spin-off series, or do you just let it die? Or I don't know.
I don't know either. I think it makes it a little bit better because it's not set immediately after.
Yeah,
you know, Game
like
of Thrones.
The fact that it's a prequel, different storyline, different characters, you know, that helps it a little bit. But I think specifically in the context, I think I'm one of those people in the camp of, if all the other books were published, I would be okay with George R. Martin's devoting his time to this. But in the context of the other two books having been written yet, I'm just like, what the fuck are you doing?
I know. Is he writing? Is he a producer on House of Dragon, or is he just a consultant? But it doesn't really matter, I guess, just get on with your freaking books, sir.
Yeah. And it's the sense of, you know, just as if the earlier seasons were really good because they relied heavily on J.R.R. Martin's, you know, writing. And I think likewise, they would need to do House of the Dragon because it's based off of Fire and Blood. So for it to be good, I think it requires Martin's, you know, serious involvement to make it good. But to make a good show, that means you're not writing your goddamn books.
Exactly. You know what? It pisses me off. How long has it been since the last one? 10 years?
Probably 10 years.
Or something?
Piece of Crows was 2005.
Well, then, yeah, like 16 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
He needs to get on with it. Just get on with it. It's pretty annoying. But anyway. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I thought it was an interesting trailer. Lots of Targaryens.
I just
lots
can't
of new faces.
I forget the actor's name, but he plays Prince Philip in seasons 1 and 2 of The Crown, and he's now a Targaryen. So just seeing him with the really platinum blonde hair, and I'm just like, yeah, it's hard, Matt, it's hard to get into the groove of, you know, seeing him like that.
Yeah, it's Matt. Oh, hang on, it's going to bother me, so I have to look it up. It's not Matt Lucas. Matt Lucas is the one who presents Great British Bake Off, but I have that in my head. But it's he has like a really funny face as well. Yeah, and I thought that Naomi Watts was going to be in it, and apparently she's not. I just don't really know. There's not many known faces. It is Matt Smith. He's going to be Daemon Targaryen.
Daemon, okay. Yeah, I don't think I got that far in Fire and Blood. I only got into like Jaehaerys and, you know, like first 150 pages of Fire and Blood. But interesting notion of just Targaryens. Like somehow this came up in talking about Targaryens or Dany's white savior complex. Jess and I were discussing it. It came up some way in Rambling Raven Pups, and I just started thinking about it more. And in terms of, I'm not accusing Martin of deliberately like doing this in any capacity, but just the imagery and the idea that this one family has this is so powerful because they have this connection to dragons, and they're totally Aryan looking with the white hair and white.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? It's really interesting. It's showing that, like, putting them in that position of power. It's kind of, what is the name of that study that Hitler was very fond of? It's not genetics. Genetics is something that actually exists.
Eugenics.
Yeah. It's very much that. And then, you know, wanting to keep it in the family. So, you know, the same bloodline keeps going. So it's the same type of, like, putting them as royalty as better than everyone else, as more powerful than everyone else.
In terms of culturally with their incestuous stuff, like, I think more of like the ancient Egyptians, because that's what they were doing, and they certainly weren't white. But yeah, just, you know, nowadays, just thinking of it, you know, the fact that they have really blonde hair and
It's very interesting.
That's why I like the idea of Jon being a Targaryen, the fact that he can have all the traits that a Targaryen and the power a Targaryen has, but in terms of his physicality, like, the Stark completely won out.
Yeah, absolutely. But isn't it curious as well that Rhaegar was allowed to marry someone who was not a Targaryen, but someone was from, like, you know, Dorne, who is completely different?
Well, again, Aerys was kind of going a little loopy. Dany wasn't born, so like for Rhaegar's age, there was no Targaryen princess for him to marry. And I think even in his deluded mind, I think Aerys understood the need that I need to create alliances to balance this this power that Tywin Lannister has over me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is true.
But anyway. Sorry to, you know, bog down into fandom and book bitching about J.R.R. Martin. So we can start with the chapter of Tyrion. Which, again, he's probably not in my top three favorite characters, but again, he is an interesting POV to enjoy.
Yeah, he's very knowledgeable, and I appreciate that. I appreciate that it's definitely a respite from Catelyn. She's so dumb. She's so dumb, it actually pisses me off. So, you know, actually reading someone who's actually intelligent and he has intelligence and he's cunning.
Yeah.
And he's funny as well. So I think his chapters are all, like, it is enjoyable to read.
Yeah, Catelyn, again, she doesn't start to get smart until she feels back in her element when she's at River Run helping Rob. But that's still a ways away.
Mm-hmm. Well, she did one smart thing. That's nice. So, you know.
So Tyrion is having, you know, dinner with Lord Mormont and the higher-ups of the Night's Watch. And... Again, Alistair Thorne, like, the fact that he cannot tolerate anyone laughing at him. It just made me think of, like, laughter and mockery and its place as being, like, one of the worst possible weapons, or the, you know, in terms of toxic masculinity, you know, the inability to laugh at yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what is happening here? We judge because it is Thorne and we hate Thorne. But what is happening here is something that I've spoken about in Rambling Raven Puffs. It's something that we call it, you know, in the UK, banter. So it's something banter. Where people just, people will just like rip into you and just, it basically the angrier that you get, the more they will take the piss out of you. Because that's what's banter, you know. But you usually do that with friends. And, you know, they're supposed to have some sort of camaraderie within the Night's Watch with one another. And then Alistair Thorne just really is not on board with that. He just doesn't.
I just always find it hilarious that Tyrion is like, has his little like crab fork. Which, you know, he's like, on guard.
Yeah. He's like, do you want to fight now? I have steel in my hand. Just poking him with it.
Yeah. Again, which, you know, there are a lot of people who criticize, you know, directors like Mel Brooks for people who portray Hitler in a comedic light.
Mm.
And, you know, all of those types of, you know, Mel Brooks and others justify, you know, their positions for taking a comedic approach is that's the best way to deny Hitler his post-mortem power is to make him laughable. Because at this, at the end of the day, the level of fascism that he was promoting was absolutely absurd.
Yeah. I mean, Hitler was a disgusting person, you know, with his beliefs and the things that he did and commanded others to do, but he was also just a mess of a person, just like really short, just insane, and he had like really bad stomach problems, so he would have really bad flatulence problems as well. I don't know if you know this.
All I know is that he killed himself on my birthday.
Oh, great.
April 30th.
Oh wow. So it's 10 days after his birthday that he killed himself. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know Hitler's birthday because it's my mom's birthday too, on the 20th of April. Dear. I know. But anyway, so he was, you know, he had horrible flatulence, and his doctor would just give him all these experimental drugs, which included meth and heroin and all. Yeah, they were just like, and obviously the Nazis as well were taking meth. Like candy. So, you know, Hitler as a person, taking away everything that he has done, he is like a pretty laughable character. And yeah, the best thing to do is take the piss out of him. You know, not forgetting, not diminishing everything that he has done. But,
but he was a really fucked up person that just was able to take advantage of the devastation of Germany from World War One and weaponize that.
And you know, when you have people who are in a fragile situation, who are in you know, a broken country, and you give them a solution for what is your problems, for, you know, what is perceived to be your problems, people will go with them.
Yep. But not to say that Alistair Thorne is on the same level as Hitler, but
no, like, not at all. He doesn't have the intelligence or that much of a malice, I don't think.
I'm kind of left with the impression that not only in Mormont, you know, giving Tyrion his escort, but the fact that he's brought this casket of like fresh seafood from Eastwatch, like he, like basically trying to butter up Tyrion as much as he possibly can, you know, to ingratiate himself to Tyrion, to like possibly have him appeal to, you know, the people he needs to in King's Landing to get resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we also find out a little bit. Hang on, before that, we just need to go back to Alistair Thorne, because it does make sense, like his grumpiness and his like the way that he hates everyone. It is because he was made to take the black by Tywin Lannister, because he was fighting on the Targaryen side.
Yes, he fighted on the Targaryen side to the end, and so that's the choice that the Lannisters. So.
Tywin. Yeah, Tywin said, you know, you either take the black or you're going to have your heads on spikes in King's Landing. So, I mean, what are the choices, right? But going back to Commander Moore, Lord Commander Mormont, he was trying to ingratiate himself to Tyrion by giving him all of those, you know, the nice crabs and whatever, that to ask him a favor, please, you know, send people over. But we also find out why, because we had this discussion on episode one. We had the discussion, like, why is Waymar Royce, a young boy of 18, being the lead in this expedition beyond the wall?
Yes, and we finally get the answer.
Yeah, we finally get the answer, which is, you know, he Jeor Mormont didn't want to offend his father.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think it just reiterates, you know, both in that statement by Mormont and then Alistair's attitude and just, you know, everyone, like, there's all this, like, borderline propaganda about the Night's Watch that were, like, this borderline monistic Jedi, you mm-hmm. know, type of order.
Yeah.
But, you know, that we don't we disassociate from our friends and family. This becomes like our life's purpose and stuff. We detach mm-hmm. ourselves from, you know, the worldly, you know, conflicts. But it's like no one has forgotten anything.
Yeah. Yeah. No. No.
Not even Mormont.
No, not at all. It's you know, you can try and distance yourself as much as you can from it.
Yeah,
but, you know, it doesn't stop being a fact, you know.
Mm-hmm. So I definitely comparatively to, again, things we see, like, you know, the Jedi Order in Star Wars, the Jedi are actually living that sort of detached, you mm-hmm. know, lifestyle, significantly more so than what the Night's Watch is trying to portray themselves as mm-hmm. to be.
Yeah, I mean, the Night's Watch still, I guess, because, you know, Star Wars is PG, but, you know, the Night's Watch still goes around, screws around, mm-hmm. you know, stray a little bit from their vows.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but I think there's, you know, I think that's a given that they're straying away from their personal vows, but even just at the macro level of these certain, you know, ideas and philosophies, like mm-hmm. like neither level, micro or macro, have, you know, do they adhere to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they're just words at the end of the day.
Words are wind.
Words are wind, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we've got Mormont, who is, you know, asking Tyrion, you know, can you please speak with the king, speak with your father, speak with your brother, like, you see how, you know, understaffed we are and all of this. I felt so bad for Mormont in this moment because... in some situations, I feel like I deal with this at work, where it's like mm-hmm. I know what I need to have to do my job at the mm-hmm. most efficient, you know, best level, and then I tell a higher up, this is what I need, and then they take it to, like, the other higher ups, and do we get what we need? No,
it's undervaluing what you do. It's, you know, it's like, oh, they've made do for time.
Yeah.
You know, they can make do with this, with how it is now.
And it's just...
it's frustrating.
And Tyrion, he's still going to do it, even though it's not going to, you know, he knows it's not going to yield mm-hmm. any result. And just Tyrion feeling a sense of, like, pity for Mormont and thinking that he needs his life to have purpose. And just, again, just dismissing the whole notion of the Night's Watch. Again, it doesn't even have to be you're believing the notion of White Walkers at this point. Just the fact that the wildlings are, their movements are changing dramatically
mm-hmm.
and coming down south significantly more, even as a purely, like, you know, mortal, like, rational threat, that is something that you probably should be invested in and think about. But it's the typical...
exactly.
It's the typical, my dad always called it crisis management. If there's no crisis, there's no management.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Yeah, it, you know, I think that Tyrion understands, but he's not going to emphasize, because at the end of the day, between the wall and King's Landing, there's a bunch of hurdles that, you know, the wildlings still have to go through.
Yeah.
So, you know, in down there, they won't be... worried.
Yeah, and, like, there's a sense that, you know, oh, Winterfell and even, like, River Run will take the brunt of it before it really becomes an actual, quote-unquote, problem.
Yeah, which is interesting, right? It's interesting, this philosophy that they have, because it is the same thing down, you know, in London, because London is where Parliament is and is the is the seat of the Prime Minister who commands. Fuck that guy. he doesn't command anything. You know, but so the Prime Minister, it's the sort of ruler of the country. And they don't care about the North. They really don't care about the North. The only time that anyone, any politician cares about the North and things that are going on beyond, like, near London, the vicinity of London, is in election time, where they go all the way up there, and that's why the North feels so disenfranchised from the rest of England or the UK, because you know, there's just no infrastructure to the North. There's no no one cares.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
even in the North of the North of England, not like even getting into Scotland, just the North of England.
Just the North of England. Yeah. And even when it was you know, COVID, well, we're still in COVID times. Yeah. I don't think we'll ever get away from it. But when we was the thick of it and we introduced these, like, absolute ridiculous, like, tiers. So, like, tier one is where it was the lightest and you could do more things, and tier three was when it was, you know, really
total lockdown,
and it was based on how many cases that of COVID and how many deaths there were in different regions. And even though, like, the North had less than some places in London, London was like tier two while the North was like tier three, because they were just like, they didn't care to listen to, you know, the people, the mayors of the towns up there. They didn't care. They just, and it's like, they didn't care that businesses were, that people were losing their livelihoods and businesses because of this tier system. They were just like, oh yeah, the North is just, yeah, let's just put them in tier three. Will I know why that got put into place? Will I really know? No, I'm not saying that I'm an expert, you know, that I'm a better expert than the government and the scientists, but it's just so you can see the stark contrast between how much they don't care.
Yeah. Makes me think of, what's that novel by Elizabeth Gaskell? North and South. Yeah, that's her magnum opus. But yeah, so, yeah, Tyrion Mormont have this talk. Is there anything else before Tyrion goes up to the wall?
I made a note here when they were feasting and, like, Maester Aemon said Tyrion was a giant. And I think that's just, like, I feel like it's really kind for him to say, because obviously Maester Aemon is blind and old. And obviously he knows that Tyrion is a dwarf, but it's the way that Tyrion presents himself and like, how intelligent he is, that makes him a giant. And I think that was, like, it was a really lovely interaction between the two of them.
Yes, it was a very sweet moment. Although I guess I'm just so used to, like, the blind wise man seeing the truth. You know, that's certainly been done many times. So, but it was a very sweet moment. And then, Tyrion goes up to the wall. And bumps into John there with Ghost.
It seems like Thorne hates John, obviously, because John's a better fighter than everyone else and he hates him. But he's also trying to, like, really put a disadvantage on him, which is making him do night watch.
Yeah, so to hope that he'll be sleep deprived and training and mess up, but hasn't worked yet. I guess I understand Alistair Thorne's, like, sourness more, because even Mormont like was saying things like, you know, I'm gonna be 70 in 2 years and who's gonna take over, like Alistair Thorne. I think Alistair Thorne understands he's reached, even though he's a higher up, he's reached the highest he can go, and I think he realizes that he's not a viable contender to be Lord Commander, and so he sees someone like Jon, and it's just like, am I gonna have to answer to this pipsqueak one day?
Yeah, you know, that kind of reminds me, not like answering to Jon, but the fact that no one wants Thorne at that, you know, at that position. It reminds me of Snape, how he's completely or constantly blocked from being the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher.
Yes, this is true.
Yeah, because, the, you know, Dumbledore knows he's dangerous.
I don't, again, Harry Potter, sidetracking, spoilers. My understanding was it wasn't so much that Dumbledore feared of Snape's, like, temptation of Snape's past. It was more like, I need Snape to stick around and I know this job is cursed. And so if I give it, and so I always framed it as Dumbledore needs to keep Snape around Hogwarts. And with the curse, he knows that if he gave Snape Defense Against the Dark Arts, then some shit would happen that would cause Snape to leave. And he didn't want that.
Oh, right. I thought it was because, you know, he was just like, you know, these were the conditions of, you know, Snape being pardoned by Dumbledore, is that he wouldn't get that job because it is quite dangerous for someone who was in the Dark Arts to be around, you know, anything to do with the Dark Arts. But then in the last, well, when he was at the Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, he proved himself to Dumbledore that he was trustworthy.
Yeah, and also, you know, he had already assigned, Dumbledore decided, you're going to kill me and therefore you are going to have to leave the school. So now it's safe for you to take the job.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyway, we'll get there.
We digress.
In Rambling Raven Pups. So I just thought it was so even more touching than, you know, Maester Aemon, the handshake between Tyrion and Jon.
They called each other friends. They were like, ooh, friends.
That was
It's a thing. I don't know if you've ever seen or heard of a sitcom that was here called The Inbetweeners, and it's this like these kids in school, and they're absolutely disgusting. It's just it's hilarious, but it's more like very British humor. So it's this group of four friends, and then one of them has a friend outside of that group of friends. So when that guy's talking about his other friend, he goes, his other friends go, ooh, friend, ooh, ooh, friend, just like taking the piss out of him.
Oh, yeah. And again, very sweet with, you know, John is asking Tyrion to help Bran, and and he's like, I can't heal him, I can't do things. And he's like, then just give him your words. And so, you know, John understanding that. Tyrion understands people, like, you know, he wants Tyrion to help Bran with his both physical disability, because Tyrion understands people with both physical and social disadvantages in the society and how to navigate them and how to make the most of one situation. And so Jon realizes this and wants Tyrion to do the same thing for Bran.
Yeah, exactly. At least what Tyrion would give Bran would be just, you know, encouragement and the fact that, not to sound cheesy, but like it does get better, not obviously to the standard that he was going, because he wanted to be a bannerman and a knight, but he would, you know, his life doesn't stop there, basically. So I think that's what, that's what Jon wanted him to.
Yeah, my uncle's out there, Jon Snow said softly. Give him time, Tyrion said. If he doesn't come back, Jon Snow promised. Ghost and I will go find him. He put his hand on the direwolf's head. I believe you, Tyrion said. But what was he thought was, and who will go find you? He shivered.
So yeah, again, this shows that Tyrion understands the lack of people from the Night's Watch. But he doesn't know how he can help because no one's going to listen to him.
Yeah.
And no one's going to go find Jon Snow.
No, it's always sad.
Yeah.
Yep. And now we move on to Arya. Which Arya is not adjusting well to castle life.
No. Well, first of all, like, Ned is never around because he's always fighting with the council.
Yeah, he's always working. And so that leaves Arya at the mercy of Septa Mordain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which, you know, from the talk that he and Arya has later on in this chapter, I understand, you know, Septa Mordain. But that's something she needs to be a bitch about it, you know?
Yeah, she needs she needs to learn different approaches. You know, it's better to appeal to children's sense of greed. Mm-hmm. And, like, she should be doing something like, oh, Arya, if you do your needlework and if you do well, that means you get to go horseback riding. Or that means mm-hmm. you get to do archery. Like, she needs to give Arya incentives.
Yeah, exactly. What I think she does, which is really shitty, and what some parents do is like compare it the children, so it makes them like seem like they are not doing anything right. So, you know, for example, in the Sansa chapter that we had, she was saying that, you know, because Sansa had Lady at the table, she was just like, oh, with that wolf, you're just like your sister. Mm-hmm. So kind of like, you know, yeah, trying to shame her off. Yeah, exactly. And with Arya, it's like, why can't you be more like your sister? Why can't you be like Sansa, again, more ladylike?
You know, certainly in this medieval period, it is unrealistic to expect Septa Mordain to be applying parenting techniques of the 20th and 21st century. But
that is true. I mean, you know, even, 10, 20 years ago, it wasn't like that. It was more like the incentive, in quotation marks, was to compare yourself to other kids, for your parents to compare you to other kids or to your siblings or whatever. And then you never feel good enough. And that's why we have a whole generation going to therapy and taking antidepressants. I'm not speaking from experience or anything.
Yeah, I don't think my parents consciously tried to compare me to my sister, but it was a situation where I was like Arya in the sense of they thought there was only one way to be, particularly in your career, to be math and science. And my sister conformed to that, you know, very effortlessly. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, in the sense that wasn't terrible at math or science, but I knew I couldn't do it fast enough to be successful at the college level. And so I went into languages. And so, yeah, definitely feeling that comparison. And, you know, one thing I'm proud of, even as a kid, that I recognized that it never damaged my relationship with my sister, because I understood that she's not doing it. She's just doing what she likes to do. I'm proud of myself that I focus my energy on, you know, and my anger towards my parents. Like, why can't you treat us equally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny because they don't understand that you're different people. Right? That, you know, if this person's good at something, why can't you be good at something? And they don't understand that, you know, different, even though, like, you have come from the same womb and you are in the same family, doesn't mean, you know, you're the exact same people with the exact same person with the exact same dreams and abilities. And it's disappointing, but.
Yeah, I could write an essay in Arabic, but could I remember how to do long division by hand? Fuck no.
No. And, you know, vice versa for your sister.
Yeah. So Arya, this is the first time in a while that, you know, they're all seated together in this sort of, like, banquet hall. It can seat 200, but there are only 50 of them. And she really used to like this context in Winterfell of her dad saying that, oh, you need to, like, you know, understand and talk to the people that you rule, and the story of every time, you know, Ned would alternate different people, you know, sitting at his table with him to, like, better understand, you know, their lives and their role and, you know, all of that things. And so Arya used to really, really enjoy that. But in the context of here, like, she usually would like being around the knights and the squires and stable hands. But again, all of them, like, killed Lady. No one did anything to stop it, not even her dad. And so specifically all these people, she's like, I hate all of you.
Yeah, I think it hurts most when it comes from the people who are closest to you, isn't it? That's what, you know, unfortunately, that's how it is. It's like, it doesn't matter that Cersei was the one who commanded to get Lady killed. She's just focusing on the fact that they had, like, they had no choice. So, you know, so it hurts the most that they didn't stop it. So yeah, I also have in my notes, like, Sansa is being annoying again.
Yeah,
Sansa is just a bitch, man.
It's just interesting, the notion of this tournament, because I feel like it has the ability to appeal to both Sansa and Arya, because Sansa, you know, interprets it as, oh, this is like the VIP event that you go to watch, and it's less about watching the events, but socializing with the people watching the events, and particularly the high-ranking men watching those events, where Arya, she should want to go just for, like, seeing the actual spectacle of the sports.
Yeah, but I think Arya is just over it. She's over everything to do with King's Landing. She hates everyone.
She's over everything at this.
And I think that, you know, if this was a tourney at Winterfell, it would be the case that you said. She would love to go and see it. But it's because, you know, she hates everyone there and she couldn't give a shit. She just wants to go back home.
Yep. And so, what was it?
The Sansa was being
annoying. Oh, like, and it's funny, like, I don't care about their stupid tourney, Arya said. She knew Prince Joffrey would be there and she hated Prince Joffrey. Sansa lifted her head. It will be a splendid event. You shan't be wanted. And anger flashed across her father's face. Enough, Sansa. More of that, Anna, you will change my mind. I'm weary unto death of this endless war you two are fighting.
So. And the thing is, even though they haven't been close, it still hurts Arya the way that Sansa is behaving towards her. Because, they've never been close and Sansa has never really been her friend, but she's a comfort from home. And I think that, like, in Arya's sort of, maybe, I don't know, that, you know, they've both been victimized. You know, with that whole situation. And what I think is that Arya doesn't understand why Sansa has turned on her.
Yeah.
When, like, she got her wolf killed, like, that she didn't get her wolf killed, but, like, her wolf got killed, so they're both sort of in the same boat, sort of, you know.
In essence, yeah, it's no shade to Maisie Williams, because of course she played Arya Stark, you know, splendidly, but I think just the nature of film, I don't feel like we got enough of the sort of, all we got was defiant Arya. We didn't get, as we can see, because obviously we're in her head in the book, the fact that deep down she wants to be accepted by her big sister.
Yeah, absolutely. She wants a friend there, and she's just not getting that. And I really feel for her. I really do. It's just really sad. It's really sad just feeling so alone like that, especially at such a young age.
Yeah, and then Arya decides to bolt from the table. She goes to, you know, they're in Tower of the King, and she literally bolts her door so, like, no one can come in after her.
And then she
starts breaking down about Micah again.
She's
rattled by so much guilt of, you know, again, the fact that you can't control crazy people like Joffrey, so all you can do is try and avoid them. And so she feels guilty of, like, if I had not suggested that we, like, play together or fight together, just that whole situation would not have occurred.
Yeah, and, you know, Sansa's being horrible. You're saying that it was all her fault, that everything that has happened is all Arya's fault. Arya is just, she was just a kid, she was just playing. You know?
Yeah, but in Sansa's spoiled mind, and everyone confirms the fact that Arya is a problem child, so, you know, around her, so Sansa's gonna adopt that as well, that just Arya as a lady should not have been out, you know, fraternizing with a butcher's boy, much less like trying to like spar with him. That just should not have happened. And
yeah. Yeah. Poor thing.
Yep. And then for comfort, she digs through her chest and pulls out needle. I don't know. I just imagined like when I said digging through her chest, it made me think of, oh, here's her Hogwarts chest and she has to dig through her school robes.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, yeah, trying to find her school robes and then, you know, finds the mirror, the two-way yeah. mirror.
Yep. But no, she finds needle and she doesn't open the door for Septimore Dane. And finally, her father comes knocking and he's mm-hmm. like, Arya, her father's voice called out, open the door, we need to talk. And so I found this very sweet that I don't feel like I paid much attention to the first time. Mm-hmm. Her father was alone. He seemed more sad than angry. That made Arya feel even worse. May I come in? So he even like asks to come in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So like much more giving her agency than probably, you know, anyone else in this freaking place, even at Winterfell, yeah. probably.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like her mother would be like, open the door right now. I'm going to come in. I'm going to have a go at you. And he's just like, his behavior towards her is giving her more credit than like her age allows, which is, to be honest, is very progressive. It's very 21st century parenting. Yeah.
Makes me think of, did you ever watch Fairly Odd Parents?
Yes. Yes.
So there is that one episode where like Timmy's dad is like knocking and he's like, Timmy, I'm respecting your privacy by knocking, but asserting my authority as your father by coming in anyway.
I love Fairly Odd Parents. It was so funny.
I love the dad's rivalry with Dinkelberg.
Oh yeah, Dinkelberg.
Yes. Anyway, but yeah, so Ned comes in and Ned is like, well, damn, I'm the hand of the king, but I don't even know what goes on in my own castle because my own daughter has a really nice, well-crafted mm-hmm. sword and I did not commission it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like his master at arms like work as well. It's like, why wasn't I told this by him? It's just like, what is going on?
Yeah, this. Yeah, and just trying. Arya's like, I don't want to be a lady. I ought to snap this toy across my knee here and now and put an end to this nonsense. But so Ned in this talk, you know, he compares Arya to Brandon and Lyanna and like having mm-hmm. the wolf's blood and being impulsive. And so, you know, for everyone else, Sansa, Catelyn, Septimore Dane, it's all about the propriety of being a lady. From Ned, it's not directly about Arya, quote unquote, being a lady. It's he wants Arya to be safe, and he knows the example of an impulsive woman like mm-hmm. his sister ended up dying.
Yeah, yeah. So he doesn't want that to befall her at all. But what Arya focuses on is that Lyanna was beautiful. That's what she thinks that he means. Not that, you know, she's reckless like Lyanna and that could get you killed. So, you know, I think he's trying to level with her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, this is like, we are surrounded by enemies. You know, you need to like get your head on straight and be nicer.
Yeah, which kind of begs the question of, he's able to recognize that he's not in the ideal place and is able to relay that to his children, to Arya, but then he still continues to do stupid shit that gets him killed.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say as well. He's just like, he's telling his daughter to play the game, but he doesn't play the game himself. So
do what I say, not what I do.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting how he doesn't.
Yeah, well, it's just
that.
Again, and also the sense of course, I'm telling Arya has to watch out for these things because she's a child and she's a girl. I'm a grown-ass man. I can handle whatever they throw at me. You know.
But yeah. And then, you know, it's really nice that he consoles her, you know, with where she says that it's all her fault, you know, that Micah got killed.
Yeah. And then he, of course, the one of the most famous quotes, let me tell you something about wolves, child. When the snow falls and the White wind blows. The lone wolf dies, but the pack survives. Summer is a time for squabbles. In winter, we must protect one another, keep each other warm, share our strength. So if you must hate Arya, hate those who would truly do us harm. Septa Mordain is a good woman. And Sansa is your sister. You may be as different as the sun and the moon, but the same blood flows through both of you. You need her and as she needs you, and I need both of you. God help me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he's trying to emphasize that it's like it's dangerous to be fighting constantly with the people who are in your house, who are, you know, your family, like not just your blood family, but, you know, your chosen family, sort of, you know, the Bannermans and the knights that come from your family, from your house.
And I'm curious if Ned had a similar conversation with Sansa. Because I feel like, to her, as a disservice to her, Sansa, I felt like, was kind of left alone because she was thriving in this environment and living in La La Land, where Ned should have been more like, okay, you're doing really good, like, you know, being polite and like everyone is liking you and you're going to the parties, like, oh, this is good, but you need to be mindful of ...
Yeah, I don't know if he had that talk with her. I really don't know.
Or and then there's the question of, even if he did attempt to have that talk with her, was it going to go in one ear and out the other? Like, was the only way that Sansa's like fantasy land going to be broken by all the terrible things that happen?
Yeah, or will it be used? Or would it be used against him? You know, because in her eyes, is anything the way that she sees King's Landing and the royal family is, you know, oh, you can't say a bad thing about them. You get punished. Which, you know, it does bite him in the arse at the end of the day, like trusting her, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess again, hindsight's 20/20, but given to now what Catelyn has said about you know, suggesting that the Lannisters, you know, attempted to kill Bran, like, even if he did not officially break off the engagement with Joffrey, again, I feel like maybe it would have been prudent for him to take Sansa aside. Now, not explain everything to her because she's a child, but say, like, you know, look, you know, there's a very good chance that this engagement, you, like, go on as everything normal, but there's a very good chance that this could end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I would understand why he would do that, but knowing what we know, he shouldn't trust her.
Yeah. Yeah, because now I'm thinking about it, I think of, if the fact that they instigated and caused the death of Lady, the fact that that isn't enough to turn Sansa against them at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
That does say something.
Yeah, one of the things that I find curious is that, so the wolves represent the Starks, right? And I think that, you know, by killing Lady, by getting rid of that first direwolf lady, it's just sort of shedding the Stark out of Sansa, you know? Yeah. Because if you think about it, all the Stark kids that have lost their wolves, they change into something else, you know?
This is true, yeah, because they, like, none of them, at least by the end of the TV show, none of them really show what a traditional, like, Stark would be.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about Bran, but that's on the show, obviously. We haven't got to that part in the book, if we'll ever get to that part in the book. But, you know, when he lost Summer, he transformed into the
Mr. Emo, angst, or I don't care about, like, anything, nihilistic, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the same day, and then, like, Rob was a Stark until the end because, you know, the Grey Wind died with him. Mm-hmm. And when you see Arya and Nymeria, like, Arya became a runaway just like Nymeria.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Ned decides to do something nice for Arya, and he invests in getting her a dancing master.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I think is very sweet. And I think he's smart enough, you know, certainly smart enough to take in Arya's, like, physicality and realize, in terms of defending herself, even she's going to fight, she should not be doing the sort of, like, traditional knight stuff. She needs to be swift and agile. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, it makes sense for him to look eastward to think of, like, what are those type of, like, fighting styles and martial arts that would be of real, you know, benefit to her. So he was, for a medieval lord, he was really thinking outside the box and was Absolutely. Willing to take on more Eastern, you know, have his daughter learn more Eastern techniques.
Yeah, yeah, he's very knowledgeable about that and knowledgeable about what kind of person his daughter needs. If she if she's not going to give that up, then he's going to give her the best advantage.
Yeah. And Sirio Forel, which, mm-hmm. you know, I was very disappointed when I found out that Sirio's famous death quote is not in the books. It was just in the TV show.
That's is it really?
Yeah, it's there's only one God and his name is Death. And there's only one thing we say to Death. Not today.
Not today. Not today, Satan.
Yeah.
Also a drag race quote, but anyway.
Yep, and so, yeah, Arya tries to hit him. Doesn't work.
No.
Yeah, she's sore all over, and then finally she tried for 4 hours until every muscle in her body was sore and aching, while Sirio Forel clicked his teeth together and told her what to do. The next day, their real work began.
Yeah, and so it starts the transition.
Indeed. And then we move on to Daenerys. They're currently on the trek to Vas Dothrak, mm-hmm. and it's the Great Grass Sea, because she is the Khaleesi of the Great Grass Sea, and I am the Khaleesi mm-hmm. of the Paperback Plateaus.
I love that.
But yeah, I love the notion of, you know, Jorah's describing, you know, the types of grasses, like there are all different types mm-hmm. of grasses, you know, by like in a few seasons, like all this grass will have red flowers, like there's other grasses, indigo, blue grasses, orange grasses. Down in the Shadowlands beyond Ashai, they say there are oceans of ghost grass taller than a man on horseback, with stalks as pale as milk glass. It murders all the grass and glows in the dark with the spirits of the day. And the Dothraki claim that someday ghost grass will cover the entire world and then all life will end. So some people have made that this is an allusion to the White Walkers.
Mm. It does make sense.
Bacon is crying again. Oh, you're a fussy kitty.
He's so funny. He's going to want to come back. It's like, yeah.
Yep. He's a back talker. Out again in a bit. He's a back sasser.
He's so cute.
Yep. So yeah, with the White Walkers, you know, definitely I can see where that symbolism and it, you know, it makes sense. Dannys, so she...
Yeah, she doesn't want to think about death, does she? She doesn't want to think about, you know, all the white grass just eating everything up and killing everything. She doesn't.
No, because, you know, she's already thinking about, what she got, you know, Viserys. You know, they've been riding for a long time, and her handmaid Eerie and the young archers of her cast were fluid as centaurs, but Viserys still struggled with their short stirrups and the flat saddle. You know, mm-hmm. that definitely made me think of, again, the, you know, Dothraki's inspiration, like the Magyars and like all the nomadic people of this, you know, the steppe empires mm-hmm. in Central Asia. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, Viserys, you know, Maester Lyrio said you should wait here with me, but he's not willing to let Dany go by herself.
Yeah, well, he's just really annoying. Like, she has had enough of his bitching and complaining, and she's just like, let me just chill here. And, you know, she's starting to have enough of her brother. She's like, sick of you. Mm-hmm. You know, and she's really finding her voice.
Yeah,
what Dany is interesting... Mm-hmm. is that, you know, it says here, where is it? Well, I don't know if it's here yet. But, you know, there's a bit that just says, Dothraki smells, they seem to belong here. And it's like, it also seems like she belongs there. She has really come to her own, but
mm-hmm.
with a lot of difficulty, because in the first few days she got really bad sores one day.
And I can definitely, as someone who rode horses as a teenager, mm-hmm. like, I certainly I wasn't riding all day, but, you know, just in terms of doing certain exercises on a horse and your thighs get sore, like, yeah, like just the idea of riding a horse, you know, day by day. The only thing that would make you more sore is riding a camel, which I've done.
Hey, oh, God. Oh, God.
Yeah, there's
like not as smooth, is it?
No, it's not smooth, because if you let your feet just dangle, like, you will be so sore. Like, there's a very specific way you need to cross your, like, legs in front of you, like, you know, leaning against, like, you know, their sort of hump, like, so you won't be sore. But yeah, other than a camel, yeah.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Ouch. Like, my leg just went a bit funny. You're just saying, you know, you can't just let your leg hang there. Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so she's just galloping around with her. She loves her silver, you know, mare that Khal Drogo gave her.
Yeah.
And they're not, you know, she's not spending all that much time with Khal Drogo. You know, he's always with his blood riders. And, you know, they eat separately and dine separately. He only comes in the middle of the night when he wants sex.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, that. Previous chapter, like her previous chapter, I thought that he was going to be a bit nicer to her, but clearly not.
Yeah, like, so, yeah, in that way, the show was accurate in portraying, you know, that element, you know, that phase, you know, of their of their relationship. And then she's been having more dragon dreams, and after the dragon dream, she's been getting stronger and stronger, you know, and getting more used to everything. And then as the rides became less an ordeal, Dani began to notice the beauties of the land around her. She rode at the head of the Khalasar with Drogo and his blood riders, so she came to each country fresh and unspoiled. They crossed the rolling hills of Norvos, past terraced farms and small villages where the townsfolk watched anxiously from atop white stucco walls. They forded three wide, placid rivers and a fourth that was swift and narrow and treacherous, camped beside a high blue waterfall, skirted the tumbled ruins of a vast dead city where ghosts were said to moan among blackened marble columns.
So, it's lovely.
Yeah, this is quite a road trip.
I know. It's really lovely to, like, see everything, to, well, read and really imagine what she's been saying as a child who, I guess... The thing is, you know, after that... it's saying that, like, after the riding became less of an ordeal, and like after all her sores, she really saw the beauty of everything. But it can also be said about like her past life as well. She was basically like letting go of everything that has happened before, and she can really open her eyes and see everything, isn't it?
Yeah, which is interesting, just, you know, from what we know happens later, and particularly in the show. But you know, I always, you know, think about what if Dani genuinely let go of Westeros and just had a life being a, whether it was directly with Khal Drogo or in Meereen, like just being a queen in somewhere in Essos, and like, you know, living out her life there and being like, okay, I have an empire. It's not the one I was born into, but I still have an empire, and that's okay.
Yeah, it shows that like Viserys really got into her head about that, you know.
Yeah, I wrote an article about like the Shakespearean end of Daenerys Targaryen, and I made several points that in seasons 7 and 8 that many of her mannerisms and certain quotes that she did were a mirror of she had become Viserys. It's like she had become Viserys, and her old position of the more vulnerable, Jon took that position.
You know, just telling Jon to bend the knee and telling people to other people to bend the knee as well. That's very like Viserys realm.
Yep. And then Viserys is absolutely incensed that she has stopped the Khalasar to like enjoy things, and he is, you know, have you forgotten who you are? Look at you. And he's like, you know, pinching her breast, like pulling her hair. You do not command the dragon. Do you understand? I am Lord of the Seven Kingdoms. I will not hear orders from some horse lord slut. Do you hear me? And Dany shoved him away. And just shoving him away shocks him.
Yeah. Yeah. She's not, it doesn't look like she's scared of him anymore. Really?
And
doesn't.
Yeah. And before he can like retaliate, you know, one of the blood riders cracks his whip and it wraps around Viserys' neck and pulls him back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even then, you know, he's pathetic. He's there, like, he's on his knees. He's, like, pulling at the whip around his neck and he's
choking,
crying.
And fluttering.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a huge contrast from what he's like, you know, yeah, the blood of the dragon or whatever.
Yeah. And it's just, and it would just, would it, again, would be interesting to see before the time the book starts, to see Viserys interact with other people, because again, whether it's like genuine like mental illness, sociopathy or whatever, but the fact that again, he's not, and probably Dany, he probably treats Dany so badly because he's the only one, she's the only thing that he has absolute control over, because, you know, even if, you know, he is obnoxious pretty much to everyone and we don't see him being very gracious or like in terms of diplomatically smart in regards to his relations with Illyrio or probably with others. But yeah, the fact that he thinks it's just a smart, he has no sense of this probably would be a bad idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So she, yeah, you know, the Blood Rider says, do you want him killed? And she's like, No, I don't want him harmed at all. She says, here, like, he lay on the ground sucking in air noisily, red-faced and sobbing. He was a pitiful thing. He had always been a pitiful thing. Why had she never seen that before? I really love someone who's been abused, just, like, realizing that they're better, you know?
And also, you know, again, in Dany realizing this, I have the note of, where is it? You know, our partner makes us see the flaws in our family of origin, you know, and, you know, it's the age-old stereotype that, you know, a person is always going to have conflict with their in-laws. And I think it's especially true, whether it's full-on abusive or just mildly dysfunctional, it's just the fact that when you, you know, even if your partner has nothing personally against your parents, it's just the fact that when you get with a partner and, you know, things that seem so normal in your normal family, they're like, what? That's crazy. That's stupid. Or even worse, that's abusive. And so when they have that third part, an external third party, and so you start to realize, you know, oh, here are some flaws in my family of origin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let me let Bacon out.
Okay.
Okay, I'm back.
Cool.
So, yeah, just the idea that now that Dany has someone else to compare him to, you know, Khal Drogo, and, you know, how he gets respect from his blood riders and, you know, all of those things, and just, and, you know, whether it's financial independence or, you know, whatever, just when you have that distance from your family of origin, and then you can finally see that, oh, I tolerated that for so long.
I can 100% relate. Not going to say anymore, but yeah. I can definitely relate. But, you know, she doesn't want him harmed, but she does want him a little bit humiliated, doesn't she? Tells them to take his horse, because he's going to walk from now on.
Yeah, and no, Viserys screamed. He turned to Ser Jorah, that pleading in the common tongue with words the horsemen would not understand. Hit her, Mormont. Hurt her. Your king commands it. Kill these Dothrathi dogs and teach her. And it's just the funny, you know, we don't know exactly, because technically, as we know, Jorah is still in the employment of, you know, Lord Varys and things like that. But in terms of maybe at a smaller level, like, this is a very pivotal point where he's just looking between the both of them and he's hedging his bets and he's like, I'm going to go with her.
Yeah, exactly. He sees that she already has more respect than Viserys will ever get from anyone. So he's betting right. He's seeing
Dany's adaptability and flexibility and willingness, you know, just to be able to be a ruler in a way that, you know, Viserys completely cannot be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think it's telling that that Dany knows it's, you know, she could have Viserys whipped or anything, but it's, if anything, it's, she knows it's more punishment to him to be humiliated, so making him walk all the way back.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. She's still a little bit, I guess, a bit worried about him. You know, concerned if he'll be able to find his way back. And then she goes, you know, oh, I woke the dragon, didn't I? And he's just like, Jorah was like, you can't wake what is already dead. Like, your brother was the last dragon. He's nothing more than a snake.
Mm-hmm. He would not be a very good king, would he? There have been worse, but not many.
Mm-hmm. She's starting to realize all of that. And then Jorah, like, just, you know, dishes some hard truths out there, you know, because she says, you know, there's the common people are waiting for him. You know, they sew banners and they're praying for Viserys to return. And then Jorah's like, they don't pray for anyone to return. They're like, they're praying for, you know, the health of their children and, you know,
crops to be plentiful.
Yeah, exactly. It's like they don't care who is ruling as long as they're left in peace, which they never are. They always get dragged into some shit.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Dany, again, euphoric, you know, moment for Dany. My brother will never take back the Seven Kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
He could not lead an army, even if my lord husband gave him one.
Exactly. She really realized that. She really realized that. Yeah.
Yeah. Because
and then she says, she, you know, because she asks him, you know, what you pray for, and he says, well, home. He wants to go back home. Mm-hmm. And she says, I pray for home too. And then Jorah, like, can clearly see what she hasn't seen yet. It's like, this is your home. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, you're so at home here that this is your home. But it's like we were talking about. She's been, like, it's been so ingrained in her brain, what Viserys said, what, you know, Viserys' ideologies is that, like, that is not her home. King's Landing, that she has never seen, she has never spent one time there, is King's Land. It's her home.
Mm-hmm. And in this way, Viserys kind of reminds me of Stannis in the way that Viserys is, like, Stannis cannot move past the notion of, you know, I'm the king and therefore I'm right and therefore I should have it, and unwilling to be strategic in terms of gaining allies and, you know,
all
of that sort of jazz. Like, he's still in this, you know, this is how the world is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. And then, you know, she's starting to take note of her dragon eggs, particularly the black and scarlet one. And my personal opinion was, because there's such emphasis on Drogon compared to the other eggs, that leaves me with the impression that, you know, Viserys and Rhaegal are going to go to other people, namely, hopefully, Jon and Tyrion.
Yeah. Yeah. That would have been nice. I would have loved to see, you know,
Tyrion on a dragon.
Tyrion on Viserys.
Yeah, give Tyrion. Dankley,
not Viserys. Ew. Tyrion riding Viserys. That's awful. Yeah, Viserion. And, like, the show would have rather, like, given. The show killed Viserion and resuscitated him as an undead dragon, then give it to poor Tyrion, who always wanted a dragon. This is just so unfair.
Yeah. But when has Game of Thrones ever been fair?
You know, it's stupid.
Yeah. But yeah, I'm hopeful that the books go in that direction of, like, you know, again, people would fear a dwarf on top of a dragon.
Mm-hmm. It just came to me. We are forgetting that, you know, we left the series with this, like, third Targaryen kid, didn't we? Well, Targaryen is like Elia and
Elia's children.
Child. One of
Rhaenys and Aemon or Aegon. I forget.
I think it's Aegon because that was supposed to be Jon's name, wasn't it? But, you know, it was just Aegon that, remember that Tyrion is riding with them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So he might be the third head of the dragon.
Yeah. Yeah, again, I don't know fully because, again, I only got a third into Dance of Dragons. So I did reach that point where Tyrion was talking to Aegon and, like, you know, advising him and strategizing with him. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Dany is talking with her handmaidens. And I like this little bit of, you know, just folklore of, you know, the moon was a dragon egg that got too close to the sun and, you know, cracked, and the dragons drank their fire, which is why they breathe fire.
Yeah, I really like that. That's really nice. And it's and another insight of the Dothraki and their legends.
Yeah. But that, yeah, because that's not their legend, because the two dot, because the other one that suggested this was from, like, Lys, and the other ones were, the Dothraki ones were, like, you know, the moon is a goddess, it's the wife of the sun, it is known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is known.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then, after getting all freshened up, she goes and has sex with Drogo outside.
Yeah, she gets some tips from, she's feeling powerful, and she gets some tips from what's her name, Doria.
Because
Doria is a bit older, she's about 20, and she comes from the pleasure brothel houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she gave her some tips, so when Khal Drogo came, she was just like, let's fuck. Yeah. My way, not your way. We're gonna go outside, everyone's gonna watch. Mm-hmm. And you're gonna look into my face. So he does. And then
Khaleesi, you are with child. I know, Dany told her. It was her 14th name day. Which again, she's pregnant at 14.
That's awful. Yeah. That's awful. I was watching the other day I was watching Poltergeist, and then the dad was talking to someone, like, about the children that he has, and, like, you know, the ages of the children, and, like, his wife. So his wife is, like, 32, and so his eldest daughter is 17,
mm-hmm.
which means that, like, they had the kid when she was 15.
Oh. Mm.
Yeah. But anyway.
Oh my god. There was a bad scandal that made the papers that a girl who got pregnant at 11...
Fuck.
Yeah, and it was...
What the hell?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. I think that's not the youngest girl that has ever gotten pregnant. I think there was a 9-year-old that got pregnant. That was like a few, like back in the 30s or something.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yes, and thus that Daenerys chapter ends with teenage pregnancy.
Barely teenage pregnancy.
Yeah, barely. Shall we move into our history lessons? So my history lesson comes from Daenerys, because when I was reading Daenerys again, just as you said, coming into her own and really adapting to the Audathri culture, that made me think of, okay, what is a very strong woman who came from one culture to another and ended up being doing very well and being very successful ruling that country and being assimilated into that culture. So who I immediately thought of was Catherine the Great, you know, of Russia, because she was originally like Germanic. She was originally Prussian. She married into, you know, into the Russian royal family, and I don't know how long after, but, you know, her husband was, like, either both mentally and physically ill. Like, basically, her husband ended up dying. And so she was left everything, and she proved to be a very, you know, formidable ruler. She was, she contributed a lot of, like, new buildings. She wrote in one of her letters, like, building is, like, an addiction to me. Like, I can't stop, like, making new, like, buildings and things like that. And, you know, she just always had this... she had this reputation of, you know, she had many lovers throughout her life, and she was very generous with them and giving them lands and other perks, and showed that of a woman going into another culture and just really doing very, very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. It's actually curious that we sort of picked the same theme. Not the same person, but sort of the same theme. So I want to, you know, whenever I see a chapter that has powerful women in it, or women coming into their own, or women being empowered, that want to reflect on female warriors that has come and gone. And so this time I want to concentrate on a female warrior. She was called Boudicca. Boudicca.
I think I've heard of her. The spelling is jogging my memory, but yeah, continue.
So when the Romans arrived in Britain, lots of Celtic tribes were mistreated. They were, you know, the taxes went up and they, you know, they were, their food were taken, and it was just a mess, basically. And one of these tribes were the Iseni, who occupied what is now Norfolk and Suffolk in the UK. So after the king of that tribe died, Queen Boudica was stripped of her possessions. She was also flogged and forced to watch her daughters be raped and tortured. And that was when she snapped. She was just like, I'm not taking this anymore. And what she did is that she built up a pretty hefty sort of army behind her. And she led a revolt against the Roman rule. And then under her fighters burned Colchester, St. Albans, London, and several military posts around the UK. And it's also known that Boudica's rebels massacred 70,000 Romans and pro-Roman Britons under her leadership. She's considered a national heroine of England. And she was also known as brutal as any man, which I love that. So yeah, a very strong warrior who is just like, I'm not gonna fucking take this.
Humiliated. Yeah, that reminds me of the Shakespeare play Titus Andronicus, where the barbarians have been defeated, and the defeated queen of the Goths, Tamora, you know, she's brought to the capital, brought to Rome, and actually the emperor ends up marrying her. And so she pretends to be all assimilated and things like that, but in reality she's plotting all of their ruin.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah, Titus Andronicus is a good one. It's really gory and disgusting, and it was hard to get through a few things, but I actually quite liked it.
That's up my alley. Maybe I'll check it out, even though I don't understand a word of Shakespeare. Never did, not even in Portuguese. Not even in Portuguese.
Wow. Alrighty then, and now we move on to our final exercise, friendship lessons. So my friendship lesson comes from Danny. It comes from, you know, again, her adapting to the Dothraki culture and just be like, so mine is, even if there's no like substantial cultural difference, take the time to get to know your friend's world and, you know, worldview and culture and things like that.
I like that. I like that. And it's important to have that knowledge of other cultures in your friendship circles. You understand more of the world and you become more empathetic.
And I apply this in my own life, you know, much more in the direct stark cultural difference, because my husband is Iranian, he's Persian, and you know, it's kind of this common pattern where a woman will like, again, start dating a man from another culture and then, you know, learn the language and learn all the stuff, you know, afterwards. But for me, that was already my academic like focus, you know, of Middle Eastern studies, and then the Persian just came along. But yeah, like definitely, you know, I'm very conservative by Western standards and he is very liberal by his own cultural standards. So that allows for us to meet each other like halfway to have a, you know, sustainable relationship. And we like, and
he completes you,
of course. And you know, we always the winter solstice is celebrated in Iran as Shabi Yalda, and so we do all the Shabi Yalda festivities every year.
Oh, I love that. You need to tell me all about it one time.
Oh yeah, Shabi Yalda literally means the night the sun was born, and you put like apples and pomegranates, like red things, to represent the sun, and then you put lots of nuts and candies, and then you like tell stories, and it's cute.
Oh, that's lovely. That's really lovely. I never knew about this, even though I had a friend who was Persian. That's interesting.
Yeah, Shabi Yalda. It's not as well known as Nowruz, which is like the spring, you know, beginning of spring festivities. But yeah, Shabi Yalda, I like it.
Oh, lovely.
So what is your friendship lesson?
So my friendship lesson comes from Ned. I think I've done, I've said this before in another variation, but play on your friend's strength and recognize and give them the advantage to become strong.
Yes. I did something similar when John gave Arya Needle. And and then I gave the story of my health teacher who ended up marrying a German and she regretted not taking German.
Yeah. I think that, Ned and John are very similar in that way, that they cultivate Arya's strengths and they want her to become, the best version that she can be. And I think that's what we should be doing to our friends, just always lifting them up and encouraging them to pursue things that make them stronger. So, yeah.
Wonderful. And thus concludes this episode of Podcaster's Landing. Who do we have next week? We have Bran, Eddard, and John.
Not Catelyn. Okay.
No. Okay, Bran, Eddard, and John. All Starks. So, catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media. Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMare Studios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.